The History of Macedonia, Alexander the Great, Battle of Issus, Part 3. Now, seeing that Darius had placed so many of his own cavalry near the sea, and perhaps also realizing that the ground on his right flank was not ideal for cavalry, or at least in the initial attack, Alexander sent the Thessalians to reinforce his left wing. They went behind the phalanx, and this and the dead ground kept them out of sight until they were in their new position. There were light infantry, including the tough Agarian mountaineers and archers on his right, but seeing the Persians threatening this wing, he reinforced them with mercenary hoplites backed by two squadrons of companion cavalry. So far, the Persian attempt to come around Alexander's right was cautious, and the Agarians, confident after so many victories and well used in operating in rough ground, pushed up into the foothills. This and the menace by the Macedonian cavalry of these Persians came down from the hills onto the level ground, to all intents and purposes, ended the threat on this wing. The two armies were still some way apart, as the rest of the Persian army waited in its positions as instructed. Alexander kept his men in hand, still halting frequently to rest and tidy up the formation. It's impossible to march in perfect formation for any distance, even over perfectly flat terrain. So this was sensible, allowing ranks to be dressed and units kept properly in line. Persians waited and watched, the enemy sometimes disappearing into the folds in the ground or hidden by dust. In the center, the long sarissas held upright so that they could sometimes be seen even when the men could not. Alexander's men filled most of the width of the plain, so the Persian advantage in numbers would not seem so obvious. While the order and precision of the slow advance was itself eerie and intimidating, Arrian says that when Alexander saw the Persians were staying put and had strengthened the north bank with defenses, he realized that Darius was in a spirit of a beaten man. Strategically, the Persian king needed to do no more than not lose the battle, but such an attitude is scarcely inspiring. Morale counts for a great deal in warfare, and most of all in battles fought at such close range. That didn't mean that the task confronting the Macedonians was an easy one. As at Granicus, the Persian occupation of the riverbank would have been enough to deter most ancient armies from attacking at all. Darius may even have expected Alexander to halt and wait a day or more before attacking, in the hope that the Persians would trust to their numerical superiority and attack him. Numbers in the ground were in the Persians' favor, but Alexander had nowhere to go and had either to fight here or retreat, aware that supplying his men would be extremely difficult with the Persians straddling his lines of communication. Always inclined to meet any real or imagined challenge, he could not decline this one. So the 23-year-old Alexander rode up and down the line, talking to each unit in turn, addressing commanders by name, encouraging all ranks. Cheers greeted him. Soldiers urged him to order the attack. Satisfied, the advance resumed, but he continued to restrain his men from surging forward and kept a slow, steady pace to avoid any part of the phalanx fluctuating in a more rapid advance or breaking apart. Only when they came to within range of the Persian bows, 200 yards at most, and less for effective range, did the attack begin. Alexander was in the lead, and almost every modern historian describes how he spurred his horse through the river at the head of the royal squadron and slammed in the Caracas on the opposite bank. As at Carinaea, it's simply assumed that Alexander was always charged on horseback, just as he supposedly always tried to extend his right and open a gap in the enemy line, as he would do at Gaugamela 2 years later. Yet Arrian's account suggests at this time he began the battle differently, as those with Alexander and Alexander himself stationed on the right were the first indeed to rush into the river at a run. So the rapidity of the attack terrified the Persians, and the speed of coming to grips lessened the damage done by the archers. The Greek for it at a run, dromo, strongly suggests an infantry charge, and the logic of Arrian's entire description is that this was at the head of one of the battalions of Hypaspis, consisting of Philip's own former royal guard. Infantry running to close with enemy archers and accepting that their formation would become ragged as the price for taking fewer missiles was a recognized tactic for the Romans. In this case, the archers were protected behind the formed Caracas, described as hoplites by Arrian, although elsewhere styled as peltas, which probably meant that they had slightly lighter armor and equipment than proper Greek hoplites. Almost as importantly, they didn't come from a society with a long tradition celebrating the aggression of phalanx fighting, nor did they have the personal experience of war and victory of the veterans that they faced. Alexander rushed impetuously into the river, engaged in hand-to-hand fighting, and was already pushing the Persians out that were stationed there. In the center, the Macedonian phalanx had a tougher time as they attacked the mercenaries ensconced behind the stronger parts of the bank. A large phalanx was always inclined to break up in a long advance, and now the charge, and even more the crossing of the river, disrupted their formations. Gaps opened and units became confused as they tried to find their way up the north bank and reach the defenders. Exploiting the opportunity, in some places, groups of mercenaries counterattacked, their spears handier in this situation than the longer Sarissa. The regimental commander, Ptolemy, son of Seleucus, died here, along with 120 pikemen as the attack stalled. Near the sea, the Persian cavalry came through the river to attack, and the Thessalian and allied cavalry under Parmenio had a difficult time holding them in check. The fighting was swaying back and forth in the way of cavalry combats, and the restricted space making it hard for the Persian numbers to come fully into play. So we now have everybody engaged, and we have this initial moment. So the next time when we get to part four, we'll be looking at the next move in the Battle of Issus. Now, the sources for this: The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. Some additional sources for the sections on Alexander rules would include, of course, Arians, The Campaigns of Alexander, In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great by Michael Wood, The Wars of Alexander the Great by Haeckel, and The Story of Alexander's Empire by Mahaffey. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.